Welcome everyone to Compiler Construction 1. My name is Michael Petter. I will be giving this lecture this semester. My co-worker, Raffaella, will at some point take over the tutorials, but I think I will be the one giving the first few tutorial sessions. So, before we start with the actual lecture, let's talk a little bit about the organizational stuff. So this event here is intended to or is given for master's or bachelor students in their third year of studies. Will be credited with 5 ECTS. There's a few prerequisites for that. There will be Informatik 1 and 2. And for the people who have not been educated at this institute for their bachelor, this means particularly that we will require a knowledge in Java for your implementations that you need to do in the tutorial sessions. So that is kind of the major prerequisite. Then there's theoretische Informatik, theoretical computer science. This is all about formal languages, automata theory. That will be the foundations for the first half of our lecture. If you haven't had anything like that so far, please, as quickly as possible, try to read the materials for that. We will be working a lot with automata and formal languages in this particular lecture. Then there's Technische Informatik, or, well, the technical basis for computing, like assembly languages. This will, of course, be of interest for a compiler construction lecture, as well, you need to translate your high-level language into something at some point, and that will be usually some low-level assembly instruction set. So, having seen an assembly language once before would be quite beneficial for that part. And then, of course, since the whole thing is a large construct that has a lot of minor tasks for which we need a general idea of how to solve them, grundlegende Algorithmen or basic algorithms would be very beneficial to you. I would assume that things like, searching and sorting and all that is things that you already know about. On the contrary, when the things that you hear in this lecture seem appealing to you, you might also consider to delve deeper into the topic with virtual machines lecture, with program optimization, with the programming languages lecture, with the practical course in compiler construction, as well as seminars that are offered at our chair. I mentioned this particularly because in this semester we also have virtual machines running in parallel. So if you're interested in kind of code generation techniques for certain programming language principles, then virtual machines lecture will be also quite interesting for you. Also, there's a little bit of an overlap with the last part of the lecture over here, so you might even benefit from that. Apart from that, there's the practical course in compiler construction that is running this semester, and if you still like to join on the fly, you can do so since it has not started yet. So far, is there any questions on prerequisites, on the general nature of things?
Is the practicum, is that like a tutorial session, or is this an actual practicum?
This is an actual lab course, so we will meet for 2 or 3 weeks and we'll be working full-time on compiler-related topic. That particular one, we will be working on the back end of the LLVM and we'll be concentrating on implementing compiler optimizations in LLVM. This is a separate course. This comes with additional credits, not the ones that you see here, but even more. Yes, please.
Three or three necessary that we program in Java, or is it possible to do that?
I won't be able to help you if you use your funky language of choice. Well, that's the least common thing that people from here have, so that's why we do Java. I might be able to give you some kind of general advice if you use something different, but don't expect me to be able to help you with technicalities in whatever funky language you plan to use. Also, I think a little bit later on there will be a few tools that are just not... well, you need to use an equivalent tool then, and I don't know whether there is one for your language. Feel free to implement them yourselves. You're learning how to do so in this course. Yes, please?
About the practical course, is it recommended to finish this course first before attending that?
This is meant to be a block course somewhere in the middle of the semester, and I would assume that... there's different tasks in that course. You won't necessarily have to have finished this course, but of course you will benefit from that. But you should bring a general interest in this kind of level of between high-level software and low-level software, because yeah, that's what this practical course will be about. Good. So. In respect to what will help you pass this course, there's materials that you can use. There's, for example, the lecture recordings. You might note the funky, colorful boxes that I draw on these things. This is to do with the lecture recording, so that you at home know what I'm referring to when I talk. So the lecture will be recorded and can be found online. For people that haven't had such recorded lectures so far, this is ttt.in.tum.de. This is kind of the entry page to the collection of recorded materials, and I will be recording this semester's compiler construction and put it up in that repository. So there you can rehearse the lectures at home, and yeah, I hope that helps a little bit. Of course, if you try to do that in a completely home fashion, that is perfectly legit. However, you must live with me maybe denying to answer a bunch of questions that pop up somewhere in the middle of the lecture that are related to the very first event. That is not what that is supposed for. If you are quite relying on personal feedback, please come here. I can't really... This one-to-one question-answer game does simply not scale for a lecture thing. But yeah, apart from that, of course, you might use them to your own pleasure. Then I have put up the slides from last year. Please note that I tend to do a few last-minute changes to the slides. Usually 1 or 2 hours before I arrive in the lecture room, And these won't be reflected in last year's slides, of course, but this doesn't make make last year's slides completely wrong or full of mistakes or all that. There might be a few mistakes still in there, even after 15 years of working with these slides. But they mostly are, well, perfectly fine for you putting your annotations there, so feel free to use them to your own pleasure. Then there's the related literature list, which I've put online on the lecture's homepage, which has, well, lives now for 2 hours, so maybe you have not yet found it. You can find it under www.in.tum.de. There you find the course description. There you will be able to obtain the tutorial sheets, and there you also find the slides and whatever organizational things are there. For the related literature in particular, what you can find there is the book on compiler design from Wilhelm Seidel and Hack. And judging by the fact that this particular person has been creating the slide set, you can imagine that there's quite a lot in parallel going on in the book and in that lecture here. And you can use that book if my explanations are not enough for you and you need a second explanation, or a second way to comprehend that, then you feel free to look inside. If you plan to, well, usually I would recommend not to buy such things, but to get them from the library. If you're really interested in that, there's a German version that you can obtain online also. But the be warned that there will be a new release of a new edition of that thing, so you might not want to buy the current edition of the book if you really would like to buy that. So please have a little bit of patience. There will be a new one. Apart from that, the further we progress into the lecture, there will be a few tools to help you. That's maybe one of the main causes why I'm not so happy with other languages than this Java thing at the moment, because we're kind of concentrating on a few very language-specific tools here, and you might have to find your own substitute for that, and I cannot guarantee that the feature set is somehow comparable. So, that's mainly the cause. What I'm talking about particularly is this JFlex and CUP thing. For the C or C++ world, you might consider things like Flex and Bison, for example, to replace them. But for the other languages, I'm not so sure whether you will be able to find substitutes for all the languages that are out there. For the last part in our lecture, as well as for the virtual machines, there's also tools for visualizing kind of low-level machine models, and that is the VAM, or the visualization of abstract machines. That is a little GUI for letting or for running programs for the particular dialect of assembly that we will be targeting. So that might be interesting to verify whether you've got your translation right. So that is the materials that we will have. Next thing about organizing the whole thing is maybe to do with things like dates. Since you all are here, it's probably not so big of an issue for you. So that is the time that we will be attending here. For the tutorial, I have put up a doodle, which I would like you that are interested in participating in the tutorial course, then please provide me with your free slots in your timetable, and I will choose the slots that are well suitable for the most people that have participated in that thing. So it's kind of a poll for what is most convenient times for you. You will be able to reach this doodle via the web page. So let's have a look whether I can access the internet in here. Looks like that. So you go to Lehre, and then you find this cogwheels. This is the page for compiler construction, and that's the link to the doodle. So you don't need to provide clear names. Choose whatever you like in there, but please, if you're interested in the tutorial, then give me some input to work on. Okay. So, with that, we will determine one or two tutorial sessions, depending on how many people are actually participating in that thing. And that's it for the tutorial and for the lecture. Then, concerning the exam, we will have one exam and one only. So, there won't be a retake on the exam until next year in the summer. That might be a showstopper for you. If so, then you know it now. However, what I do in these exams is I will be allowing to bring printed or written materials to your liking. So it's an open book exam. So you won't need to learn by heart whatever you might feel. However, I would still recommend to take part in the exercises and try to stay with the class in terms of progress. Otherwise, there's a whole lot of whole block of things to learn.
In case someone can't attend the tutorials, would the solution be to have them?
Yeah, we will put them online. So, yeah, that is the deal with compiler construction and programming languages. One exam only, but I try to be somewhat humane with that. So, next thing, because questions pop up again and again and again, I don't know the exam date until the same time that it gets published at TUM Online. So I will be able to know about the exam time as soon as you know it. Also, I can't move it around. So it's predetermined by our central facilities, and usually the examination rooms are quite scarce, even during the semester break, and I can't do a lot about that. If there happens to be an overlap with another examination at the same time or even on the same day, let's say, please tell me about that as early as possible, and we will try to find a solution so that you don't have to pass on this course during this semester, but we will find a way to arrange some substitute in that case. Apart from that, there's the matter of homework. Homework is free to your own liking. If you like to hand in homework, you will get some comments on that. So that is possible, but you're not required to hand in any solutions to exercises. However, we found out that it's quite popular for you to kind of earn yourself a little bit of a bonus on your final grade by doing some kind of extra work. So we offer that to you also in the form of giving a mini talk. So there will be a mini semester, mini seminar at the end of the semester. This will mean that you will have kind of quarter of an hour to 20 minutes, somewhat around that, as time for your short talk. And this will concentrate on a particular topic from the area of compiler construction. So I've put together a few example topics. Depending on how many people actually sign up for such a mini topic, a mini seminar, I will try to generate a few more that, yeah, until the whole, until the course is satisfied, so to say. So there's, for example, what you could talk about is introduction to parser combinators. People who like functional programming are maybe eager to contribute that topic. Then there's a topic on two extensions to LRK parsing that are offering a lot more comfort than the ones that we have so far, which is Pages LRK algorithms. There's two notions of that, so two talks for that. Also from functional programming, there's the concept of type inference that we won't find directly in the slides. So this will be a split talk. One person will present Hindley-Milner type systems and the constraints that are, the rule sets that are introduced there, and the other one will concentrate on making an algorithm out of this rule set, which is this W algorithm. Then we move on to more topics closer to the actual code generation, which will be the topic of single static assignment form, for example, and that has certain consequences on the design of your code generation phase, of the code that you will get out of that, of the algorithm that you have to apply in order to get machine executable code out of that, and a few consequences on the optimizations that you can do quite nicely on this single static assignment form code. And then we will offer, for example, a few notions of, well, what problems arise when you try to do register allocation for a concrete machine. That is also worth a few talks, I would say. So there's a lot of topics where we can find appropriate talks. We will, as usually, the attendance of this course shrink down to, well, let's say half of people that are here initially. I would wait with giving the seminar topics to you until it stabilizes a little bit, so that I don't have to invent topics twice as much as needed. So I think when we start with LRK parsing, this will be the point in time where we will hand out the topics, and then you've got the time to prepare that. Okay, so any questions on that? Good. So what we will actually have as content in this course is the architecture and implementation of general compilers that encompasses to talk about regular expressions and finite automata, thus the connection to theoretical computer science. How to use that as specification and implementation for the scanner component of a compiler. Then next we will be treating context-free grammars and pushdown automata, so the next connection to theoretical computer science. We will talk about how to use these kind of general concepts in order to come up with an algorithm that provides either top-down or bottom-up syntax analysis. With that, we will then proceed to how to actually set up a concrete parser. We will then proceed to kind of the middle ground of the whole thing, which will be the semantic analysis with attribute systems, which are kind of an extended version of grammars. So it's grammars attached with attributes and certain rules how to evaluate the attributes. We will be talking about an application of that in the form of type checking. So that will be the use for the attribute systems. And as the second application of that, we will then talk about how we can set up an attribute system in order to provide code generation for an example language into register machines, it is in this case. If then there's still time, we might talk a little bit about register assignment and basic optimization, but that remains to be seen whether we reach that part or not. Usually I'm too slow to reach that part, but if you're interested in optimization techniques, I recommend to you to go to the winter semester's lecture of program optimization. So, that is the content of the lecture. Let's start with a few general thoughts on how compilers actually work, or the general problem of running a high-level specification of a program. So, in this area, there's two kind of extreme forms of how to solve the problem of executing a high-level program on a low-level machine. And kind of one extreme is the idea of interpreting the whole program on the high level. Usually, what you do is you get a program together with an input, and if you have both of them, you then start doing something, which will be running an interpreter that will try to directly apply the high-level code onto the input, and while doing so on the fly, try to do the necessary support computations that are needed in order to be able to decipher the meaning of the high-level code, and will produce the output as the result. The kind of other extreme of that thing is the approach of compilation. What you do there is, instead of doing everything at once, you consider that there's a potential for optimization by pulling out the supporting computations into a separate phase, which is called the compilation phase, and performing them once and for all, and reuse the results to their best use during the runtime of the program. So you then separate between compilation time and runtime. Thus, in that setting, you take the program as input with a goal to produce the same output as the interpretation approach, but you have an intermediate layer, which is the actual code that you produce. You produce that once with your compiler, and then afterwards, when you have successfully produced the code, you will take the code together with an input and let it run directly on a particular machine for which you have generated the code for, and will get the same output as the approach of interpretation. These are very different approaches in a certain sense, so that you can find them in opposite corners of the room, so to say. And what you find in practical systems is not always as black and white as this slide makes it appear. So, for example, if you take let's talk about these languages like Java or C Sharp, which have their virtual machine, which people usually expect to work a little bit like the interpretation approach. And in the case of Java, for example, that's completely right. It started off as an interpretation approach, at least in the sense that, you had a little bit of a compilation phase going on, but that didn't produce very much optimized code, but just translated the kind of the ASCII files into some more condensed version of things. But there weren't a lot of optimization actually going on. And usually people considered this as still an interpreter of, well, JVM code in that sense. However, as the years evolved, the implementation of the actual interpreter of JVM code was taking more and more concepts from compiler construction into its or under its hood, and in that sense did a little bit of on-the-fly compilation and caching the results, which was already a little bit like the compilation approach. And also a lot of the optimizations and the more heavy weight optimizations from the compiler approach made its way into the JVM interpreters in the form of hotspot compiling. And so you had kind of a mixture of both of the extremes in these things. And you can observe such things in a lot of the current runtimes. So it's not a purely interpreted, most of cases there's no purely interpreted languages anymore, and a lot of times also a compilation might get a little bit of help from the runtime in terms of, receiving a log of what has happened at runtime and then re-optimizing your code once again, and thus it's not such a clear image anymore that you get from this world. Yes?
Can we say that part of a program compiler code is independent of the second step, which is the code machine output?
Well, what is independent? You have a common dependency with the kind of code that you create.
Without knowing the machine, can you generate? Is the code machine dependent, or we generate something that is very general and every machine can read?
Depends on where you cut your layered system, and if you cut it high level enough, then you might imagine something like a portable machine code. You might also consider a low-level interpreter as just kind of a runtime system for some other code. So simulating x86 code and some other architecture or something. If you don't use too specific code in your code generation scheme, then that might be completely feasible and not a lot of overhead. And then it's not so clear to say. There has been the idea of LLVM, which is started with the idea of creating a kind of assembly language on a very abstract level, so that you can retarget your code very easily. Turns out that to a certain degree that is still in the code, but there's a few things that can't be so easily rewritten, in the sense that, for example, the bit length of your main data types, you have to mention them at some point, and then switching around between 32 and 64 bit machines, for example, is not that easy if you still want to have actual performant code. So to a certain degree you can, but it's maybe not very satisfying to do so. And, well, maybe also something like the Java virtual machine, or something like the Dalvik machine, which is Google's version of that, which went from a stack-based machine to a register-based machine, could be considered as kind of a portable assembly interpreter, so to say. But, yeah, well... If you ask the people from Google, then they're still not very satisfied with the code that they get in form of the Dalvik's input, and still do a lot of optimizations under the hood. So, yeah, you lose a lot of specialization, and with that potentially a lot of performance if you do so. Good. Yeah. So what you buy yourself into with interpretation is that usually there is no compilation phase that needs to be done. So you can start right off from your program text and don't have any kind of large startup phase where you have to perform your compilation. You start right off, but maybe not so much about downsides. What you also get in interpreter-based approaches is that as you are working with the program in high-level form as well as the input, you might be able to perform very aggressive optimization due to the fact that you have a fixed input already at your disposal, and you can use that to specialize the code that you're executing even more as a static compiler, which would have to generate code that is flexible to work with any input. So with that, you could, for example, just inline certain parts of the input that is important for the performance of your program. And you can do so much more aggressively if you know ahead of actually of arranging your program code than if you have to remain open for arbitrary inputs. And that could be an advantage for interpreter-based systems, and has been proven to be an advantage for these hotspot-based interpreters. They can just do a lot more aggressive constant propagation, for example, when they start optimizing in the middle of the program, when the initialization phase is already over, and a few variables that aren't changed anymore in the program later on can be assumed to be constant, for example, and that makes a huge difference. There's a lot of real world programs, there's also a lot of compilation flags, for example, and a lot of debug things that are kept variable in the code, which will, for an actual application, always evaluate to a certain thing and then render complete large fractions of your code just unreachable, and a static compiler still has to generate code for that and incorporate that into the binary and all that. And with an interpretation approach that makes use of this aggressive optimization, this just won't be an issue. In favor of compilation is that if you want to execute code that stems from high-level language features, you will have to do a lot of helper computations. For example, if you use variables, you might be interested in where to find them in your memory layout. You might be interested in how they are arranged in terms of what field goes where and all that. And this is computations that are not really depending on each instance when the program is run, but these are things that you can pre-compute and reuse every time that you want to execute that program. So what you do is you analyze these questions once during this pre-processing that we call compilation, instead of the execution each time that we want that we are interested in that thing. With that, we get although we get a compilation phase, which might be arbitrary expensive, we usually have a much smaller runtime overhead when actually executing the programs that stem from a compilation. And for long-running programs and programs that tend to be called a lot of times, this might pay off big. Apart from that, what's also the case is that if you compile, well, of course, during development, you might be interested in very fast compilation runs because you want to check whether your program is actually specified correctly. However, in general, if you're done with most of your program, you might not care anymore about the actual runtime of the compilation phase. If it takes an hour, so be it. But if it is really fast afterwards, then this might pay off big time, particularly when the problem complexity of the actual program that you're writing is much bigger than the task of actually translating your program. So, is the big advantage of a compiler. So, in general, for the rest of the lecture, we won't disambiguate anymore between this interpreter and compiler approach, because the actual means that are used within the interpreter or the compiler are actually pretty much similar, except for kind of the timing when you do these particular things. So all of the techniques that we will show you here, you will find in interpreters as well as in compilers to a certain degree. So we will keep this image of having program code and producing kind of target code. In the interpreter, we would not put out the target code, but we would feed the processor's code page or something. So it's largely not so relevant for the actual particulars of the architecture of the compiler. So, what you find in all of these things is the aspect of deciphering the input in the sense of performing analysis of the high-level code. So that is one part that is done in the compiler, which will lead to an internal representation, which will have stripped away a lot of the ambiguity of input. It will try to concentrate on the actual meaning of what the high-level code has been, and will use a suitable internal representation for that. And with that, then the synthesis phases will start, which will be the phase that will actually take this internal representation and produce target code from that. So that's the analysis and synthesis. For the first part of lecture, we will concentrate on the analysis phase. which by itself is also divided in certain phases. So the analysis phase is started on the high-level program code. This will be the input for the analysis phase, where it will first get chopped into little bits of meaning by the first component that we call the scanner. So the scanner's purpose is to take largely, well, the most general form that it will see will be just a very, very long string representation of the input, and the scanner is meant to facilitate the work of the phases that come thereafter by grouping characters into certain substrings that belong some together in some particular meaningful way. For example, you would rather have your compiler interpreting a number not digit-wise but as a whole if they're meant to express a number, for example. So that is the purpose of a scanner. It will take the initial string and break it into substrings that are somehow well, corresponding to a certain meaning. What the scanner produces is a stream of these fragments of the original input string, and we call that the token stream. A token is one of these broken pieces of the input. With that, we will feed the next phase of the compiler in the analysis phase, and that is the so-called parser. The parser works on these piece or units of meaning that are produced by the scanner. So it works on token streams and try to figure out how they interact with each other, in the sense that it tries to find out what the hierarchical structure of the input has been. And you might wonder whether a hierarchy is usually what comes out of when you write your high-level program, but, well, you can consider for example, even spoken language as something which is organized in a hierarchical way. You have your grammar, for example, for your language of choice, and this is organized in a hierarchical way, where you have a sentence as a certain unit of meaning, which can be broken down into how the sentence is made up, which can be even more broken down until you reach the layer of words, which would be the units of meaning of spoken language. And that's the same concept here. The parser tries to find out about the hierarchical structure of your input. Good. What it will do is it will, in order to give the programmer a grasp on the hierarchical structure of the whole thing, it will create such a hierarchical structure in the form of a tree, which is called the syntax tree. So that will be the product of the parser phase. So from token stream to syntax tree with the parser. And from that point on, there's still the last phase of the analysis phase of the compiler, which is the so-called semantic analysis, which will then try to find out about properties that are not expressible within hierarchical structures. That sounds complicated, but that just means that, well, with grammar and syntax trees, you're limited in what you can express. there are certain properties that you can't really express in that way. The typical example is the one that you see mentioned here in the box. That's the type checker, for example, or even to make it more simple, the definition use analysis. It's not expressible in hierarchical form whether a variable name that you find somewhere in your program has been properly defined with respect to scoping, such that the name is actually that each name has its particular definition. So for that you need to do even more. You need to process the syntax tree in a certain way, and that is what the semantic analysis is all about. And as example, we will see how the type checker works in these things. So with that, this last phase of semantic analysis will get us input the syntax tree, of course, the result of the hierarchical analysis or the syntax analysis, and what it will produce is an annotated syntax tree which carries, for example, just continue with the example of this definition use, you will get pointers from for a spot where you have found the use of a variable to the spot in the syntax tree where that particular variable has been defined. So that if you encounter the usage of a variable, you can look up its type and its layout in memory or whatever you might want to have. Might want to work on. So that will leave you with an annotated syntax tree, which will be the result of the analysis phase. So that's what we're going to work on, and particularly we will see how a scanner is working in the first part of the lecture. So let's talk about that in the chapter of lexical analysis, because that's what a scanner does. So, we have talked about that right before, so that's already known. We get as an input to a scanner program code in the form of, well, text file or, well, just basically an arbitrary string. And this will be given to the scanner. This is a black box and will then produce as output the token stream. If you look at that in an example, you might have language for a calculator or something, or arithmetic expressions. There you might have something like that, where you just see the whole thing as one string. And what the scanner provides you is it cuts the input at particular spots and breaks it down into so-called tokens. Even more, what it does is, well, we'll see maybe later on a little bit. So, a token is just, considered a sequence of characters that that belong together according to certain concept, and thus form a unit of interest for us. How they should be grouped is depending on the language, of course, that you want to translate. And most of these languages have, all of the ones that we're talking about here, have the concept of token classes, which define what we are actually talking about with respect to each of these units. So examples for token classes could be, for example, names of variables, of fields, of functions, of classes, of structures, whatever you might want to name in your or even maybe labels for jumps or anything, whatever you might want to to give names to in your language, that is done with the help of one of these units. In compiler speak, you don't speak about names, you talk about so-called identifiers. They identify a certain variable. In an example, well, you might come up with arbitrary names. All of you have already learned a programming language, you know what these names might be. It's variable names, field names, whatever, x, y, z, pi, you can just choose a name to your liking. There's certain rules that say what you can do and what you cannot do. You can't use spaces in there. You are not allowed to use maybe stars or pluses in there. Anything like that is probably a rule that makes up what a valid identifier is. And in our example, we have an identifier, for example, over here. And the scanner not only just chops the input into these tokens, what it also does is it labels each token with the class that it has found this particular token to correspond to. So it would label the first token with I or ID or whatever, just the some name for that particular class. What also would be a valid class is constants, and there might even be subclasses like integer constants or float constants, string constants, Boolean constants, whatever you might dream of. And yeah, those are constants, and yeah, we have such a thing, for example, also here. So that would be a constant token. You could also imagine operator to be a token, or, well, languages might have reserved terms that somehow make up whatever you use there. Function, if, int, while, program, class, whatever, or extends, or whatever you might expect. That might be a reserved term that might collide with the way that you can specify names, but that's why they are called reserved. They are somehow excluded from the normal identifiers. So that's what you usually find for tokens. So that was an operator. Yeah, so that is what the scanner usually produces. It produces sequences of tokens, and a token is a sequence of characters and a classification in terms of token classes. Good. With that, what you usually would want to do is, well, you can imagine several ways of making use of these things. For example, you might, well, the first one is most ridiculous one, maybe, if you just read drop the token, but that actually makes sense. For example, for spacing, a lot of languages might not really care whether you have used a tabulator for spacing, or five spaces or three spaces. It just throws them away anyway. So that's what the white space class is usually done. It's just dropped. Then there's the aspect of comments, and a comment, well, depending on what language you use, it might be dropped, it might be, well, for example, if you, with respect to the certain tools in program development, you might have a separate parser that will just look for comments and not for the actual program structure, and try to generate documentation out of that. So it's either dropped, or it's either this, or the center of your interest, so to say. So depends on what you're going for. What you also might do with tokens is you would want to collect something like pragmas, which are certain kind of special purpose directives in your language or around your language that help with hinting the compiler what to do if there's several design choices of how to produce your code. This has been, for example, used or misused for OpenMP programs. You have pragmas where you can specify how to parallelize the otherwise sequential code. So that would be a use for tokens and is kind of caught at that particular level already. What you could also do is you could replace tokens of particular classes with their meanings. For example, if you already have figured out that you have found an integer constant, is it really necessary to still represent it as a sequence of characters, or would you rather have it as an actual integer in memory, which you can then directly use afterwards? So you might already convert your string into the actual value, so that could be done with constants. Then names, for example, you might want to not explicitly keep names in memory, but instead, for example, use something like a string pool where you store the elaborate name of the variable or whatever you have named, and instead use a kind of an internal code which refers to your string pool. You could also kind of normalize the names to a certain degree. For example, in C++, when you look into the object files of what the compiler produces, you will see that there's a certain way of composing the internal name of the variable from the kind of thing that you're actually talking about. For example, for functions, you might consider the parameters and the return type and the class for which this function is a member or something. So you can make up an internal form of your name also at that level, for example, already. And what else? You can could, for example, directly use the output of lexical analysis to, for example, do something like syntax coloring. So if you like to have a syntax coloring editor, you could let your scanner work on your input and then choose a specific color for each of the token classes that are produced by your scanner, and then highlight your code in the fashion that you like. So that was usually a way to produce nicer code, I think. Yeah. In literature, you might find that between scanner and parser, there's an additional layer in some approaches, in some there's none. And that particular thing is called the siever. This is to do with this issue of dropping irrelevant fragments out of the actual input. It's kind of associated with the sieve. So you try to only obtain pure code without any spacing and comments and any other irrelevant stuff. So that's what the aspect of sieving that is here integrated in our concept of scanner already. So that's our component approach. Now that we've talked about the input and the output a lot, the question is now, how does this black box, or yellow box in that sense, generator actually works, and or scanner actually works? And you see the answer already here. So what we have is we usually would not try to work with a handwritten scanner, but instead we would like to use a specification that will go as an input into the generator that will produce the scanner for us. So I don't know. Is there anyone in here who has already tried to parse something like a configuration file or something for your program? So have any of those tried to do that manually at some point with just getting your configuration file as as carriage return terminated strings? Yeah, so you know maybe a little bit of the hassles that you get if you do that manually. Turns out that it's the same for any case where you read an input file. You always have to solve the same issues over and over and over again. It's always a matter of specifying what the input should look like, what you're looking for terminating a certain expression, statement, or whatever. It's always same things that you're after, and in most of the cases, you will at some point make use of features like regular expression libraries that are provided by your language and so on. And with that, you're already halfway into what an approach with scanner generator would give you. So the scanner generator works by reading a lot of specifications in the form of regular expressions, and what it will provide is a very large automaton that will be suitable to parse the complete file. No hassle with looking out for carriage returns or any other means of terminators. That's all covered by the thing that the generator provides. Yes.
So in that case, do we always just throw them out?
I don't know how the Python grammar, for example, is formulated. Whether there is kind of whether there's actually a concept for each individual white space, or whether you could maybe group them into a general white space of which five or something. That depends on how your language is actually defined. So I can't give a general answer to that. But there's languages out there for which you just would not sieve out any white spaces. There's also older ones like COBOL, for example, where it's also meaningful to preserve the white spaces and all that. So yeah, it's just the a more modern approach as well. Maybe not Python, because that is also a modern thing, so to say, but they usually throw them away. But of course, there's a few languages that are still counting these things. So anyway, you could still come up with a generated scanner for these things. You would just then pass on the information of the white spaces to the next phase, because they are still relevant. So what you do is you kind of try to automate what a few of you have already done by hand, and specify with just regular expressions, and then callback actions for whenever these regular expressions are matched. The question is now, how is this this regular expression thing actually brought into a form which is friendly to be executed on any machine in form of a program? And that is what we're going to talk about in this and the next lecture probably. So we'll start with the foundations, basics of what are regular expressions. So, first of all, about the shape, what is a regular expression actually looking like? So, regular expressions are made to express certain structure with respect to the underlying program. So, these regular expressions are expected to work on the same alphabet on which the program code is actually formulated. So we have a fixed alphabet of what is a of what is valid input to our program. For example, in your language definition, you might find that Unicode is accepted as input for your program. So that would be the alphabet of your regular expressions. The sets of text fragments of a token class, so what a token class is actually associated with is in general described via rules, so it's considered to be regular. And these rules can be specified with so-called regular expressions that are defined recursively in a very specific form. So that's what this definition here is about. That's what regular expressions look like on the formal level. So regular expressions are considered to be, well, the empty string, for example, is considered as a regular expression. And as empty strings are always so tedious to denotate, we use the epsilon to actually signify that there's no character at all at that point. But since no character at all is difficult to print, we use this epsilon thing. Other regular expressions are just characters from the alphabet. So each character from the alphabet by itself is considered to be a valid regular expression. And with that, with the empty string and the characters from the alphabet, you then recursively define your regular expressions with composed expressions. So you can compose two things that are already considered regular expressions with a bar in the middle and brackets left and right, with a dot in the middle, brackets left and right, or with a star in superscript. So that's what regular expressions in our case look like. So far there's no meaning attached to that, that's just pure syntax. So with these rules you can set up what would be considered to be a valid regular expression. For example, the things that you find here would be valid regular expressions in case that A and B would be characters from the underlying alphabet. So far, not too surprising, I hope. A few words on the notation here. I use blue color to denotate characters from the alphabet, and pink for meta symbols. These are these arbitrary bar, bracket, and star and dot that we introduced in our definition. And in order to avoid a lot of redundant things, we introduce operator precedences. So star beats dot beats bar. And also we say that if we find no symbol there, then we assume that it is a dot. So we usually leave the dot outside, and with that we could, for example, we could change the more complex things from over there. But anyway, in real regular expressions, in the real world, you might also find a few other operators that are, in our terms, just syntactic transformations into things that we can already express with our very small subset of regular expressions. So this question mark is interpreted as kind of a synonym for this epsilon bar, the original expression, and the plus thing is just e dot e star, so to say, and that's that. Good. So so far, that's the structure of regular expressions. They look like that. Now, what is the actual meaning attached to regular expressions? Meaning is what we call semantics, and in our case, since we're talking about strings of things, we will define the semantics of our constructs by sets of strings. So if I find, for example, a set specification of regular expression like this ABAB, I can assign it a certain semantics, and in our case what this will be, or what we desire this to mean, would be the set consisting of exactly one element, which would be the string ABAB. So the dot thing doesn't create too much of a fuss. It will just be used to concatenate the input at some point. Then, for example, the bar operator here, if we look at the, what that actually means in terms of sets of strings, this will mean the set containing either A or B, or, well, the set, it, the set actually contains both of them. So the semantics of A bar B means A and B in there. So a little bit more complex example here. This is A, B star A. If I want to specify a semantics for that, I run into a little bit of a problem, because this star operator will kind of blow up arbitrarily. So this could mean just AA, this could mean ABA, ABBA, and whatever number of B's you would actually mean, would actually want to have. And on all, I can only express what that means with the help of one of these descriptor things attached to my set. So all the words that start with an A and end with an A and have arbitrarily many B's in there are covered in with this specification, and this creates an infinite set as the semantics of that particular regular expression. So this was kind of the intuitive or unintuitive go at reading what this or defining. Well, it's not really a definition, it's just a go at a few examples of specifications and what the semantics actually are for these things. So in order to define what these things mean, we do so inductively with the semantics brackets. These double brackets over here, they mean the operators that generate the semantics from a certain specification thing. So these brackets are the operators that do the jump from this to this. So let's start in an inductive way from the basic elements of what a regular expression is, and that would be the empty string, or the null string, so to say, and the semantics of that would be the set comprising the string of length 0. So that's not to be confused with the actual empty set. That's something different. So we differentiate between the set that contains the empty string and the empty set. Then there's the character symbols from the alphabet, and they can be directly interpreted as set of exactly that character. Then there's the more complex expressions in the semantic in the specifications of regular expressions. For example, the star, and the star is meant to evaluate to recursively the semantics of the sub-expression E, and then an ominous application of another star. That seems like cheating, but yeah, we will actually turn the page in a few seconds, and there we will find the what that means. The bar, for example, would translate into the semantics of each of the sub-expressions E1 and E2 and the union of those. So that would be the example that we have seen over here. That's the A bar B would translate into the union of the set containing A and the set containing B, which will result in this thing. Then finally, there's the dot operator, which will also translate in an ominous dot, which we will see on the next slide. So these are the two missing operators. These are now operators not on regular expressions, but meant to be operators on sets. So change of signature there means also different domains to work on. So that's for the more programming oriented people, that's completely different operators, so to say. So the one thing is mapping to an operator with a different signature. So we are still missing what star on sets of words means and what dot on sets of word means. I think union is something that we can all accept as being known. So what is star on sets of strings? And what it means is that you take words from the subset, so to say, of the set L, and repeat them several times. So this is just a repetition of the words found in the underlying language, which is set of strings. What is the dot operator on sets of strings? Well, what you essentially do is you can pick any word from the first set of strings and any word of the second set of the strings. You can concatenate them together, and if you do that in a kind of cross product way, you get your result in terms of sets of strings. So that's what these operators actually mean. And with that, we have defined the semantics of regular expressions. It translates into operations on sets. So a few other things with regular expressions that we will use later on will be that we keep in mind that for regular expressions, as this is just another type of language, so to say, we can represent them also in their syntax tree form. And for example, in this case here, we have regular expression that looks like this. We can also, well, just directly interpret that as its syntax tree, which is this AB. There's an implicit concatenation going on between them. Then there's an alternation operator over here with the empty string over here, and the whole thing is repeated arbitrarily often. So that is kind of the syntax tree representation of that. We will make use of that later on when we work on translating one into the other. The inner nodes of such a syntax tree would be operator applications, while the leaves would be particular input characters or the empty string, depending on whatever we find in the regular expression. So, with that in mind, we have the means to specify our token classes. Maybe a few examples for regular expressions, taken in this case from Java. So what you usually find as token classes for languages is identifiers. Here the way that I found that for a Java scanner in that case. So you usually, well, you can do so, but it's not recommended to kind of try to specify regular expression in one go. What you instead do is introduce kind of macros in a certain sense, and that's what's happening here. So that the particular regular expression engine here was capable of having macros. So you would define a macro with a name, LE here, short for letter, would be considered to be such a thing. And this is, well, a little bit of special syntax that this particular regular expression engine had going on. So instead of listing A bar B bar C bar whatever to Z, you could instead express the same thing with something like this. So use square brackets and this line in the middle, and with that you would express the same same thing as just a large alternation of things. So this means all the letters, all the characters from small a to small z, large a to large z, underscore, and the dollar symbol. So that is what is considered to be a letter in this in terms of a macro. Then you would introduce, introduce another macro, DI for digit in that case, which would be now easily readable. That's just all the digits from 0 to 9. Not a big deal. And now you can start defining what the actual identifier would look like. So the identifier is meant to be the macro for a letter, followed by or concatenated to a repetition of either a letter or a digit. So you can vary now between letters and digit, but the first thing needs to be a letter. So that's what constitutes an identifier in that particular language. Why do you introduce these macros? The purpose is you might reuse a few of the concepts that you introduce here. For example, for whatever constitutes to a float. And there you see it's quite convenient to have these macros instead of having to type the particular regular expressions again and again and again. So you might want to decipher what these parts actually mean, maybe. Well, they are floats, so you have a certain hint of what they could actually mean, but maybe you could help in deciphering what that actually means a little bit. Maybe it doesn't need to be the whole thing, but maybe already a little bit helps. So it's about I didn't get it completely. So it was you can start with a point, you said.
You can start with a number or with a point.
I guess from what you're saying is you referring to that part. Exactly. So, this is already mostly what it's all about. The thing is for floats is that you are allowed to either start with digits, and then at some point use full stop, or you might even start just with a full stop and continue with digits. So either way, you will maybe find digits at the start. That's what this digit clean star means here. But we're perfectly fine without any, because Either you then find a full stop with a digit following, and maybe arbitrary many afterwards, or you might find a digit also with a full stop and then arbitrary many of those or none, depending on what you mean. But this way of specifying the first part makes sure that a single full stop alone won't be considered to be a valid float. It always needs to be either preceded or followed by a digit.
But this regular expression would not rule out meaning zeros at the start. It's like if I 0001.10.
Why not?
Because a digit can be zero, so I can have as many meaning zeros as I want, and it would still be a valid float.
Yes.
Is that really it? That is in most languages not allowed.
Is it not?
I guess. I just have a feeling that it should not be allowed.
Has anyone a computer with a compiler open? I would like to actually. I'm interested. I simply don't know. I would have guessed it is legal, but that's right down to specification what the language really allows. So I could imagine there's languages that would still have the definition like this, but after finding such a pattern, try to filter what is valid or not. So, from a perspective of what is actually a valid specification, I'm quite interested. But I would say, in a technical way, I would consider most of the scanner parser combinations to work like. You would specify it like this, and then in the action part where you interpret what you have found, you would probably filter and yield a warning or an error or something if you have this kind of thing not being suitable for your language. That is the thing with scanners and parsers. You would try to not put a lot of extra encoded intelligence into these very weak not so expressive formalisms, and delay the actual decision about more complex features till later on. But that's more on philosophy of how to write one of these things. That's an escape character to make sure that this, because the full stop is a match all operator in that particular tool. So yeah, it's wildcard. If you don't use the backslash. Yeah, and that part over here, to make things short, because we run out of time, this will the part where you can determine your exponent of your float representation. So you have a small lower caps or large caps E, and then a plus minus and some other combination of digits. And that's an optional thing, so that's why this thing is over here. Yes, and with that, we're done with lexical analysis, and we will continue with finite automata and conversion of regular expressions to finite automata next time. Thank you for your attention, and please remember to vote for your tutorial if you're interested in going there. And do so, please, until tomorrow at 12, and I will try to find a room and schedule everything so that we can already continue next week with a tutorial session. So thank you all for your attention, and have a nice week, or what remains of this week.